journalistic instinct that led me to them, and that kept me close to them for a period of a few years. And when I first met them, the mom, Maria Elena, was just kept on telling the surviving her surviving children, "Don't go. I just want everybody to remain here and be at my side, and let's just try to heal ourselves as a family on this side of the border." But Rosa Chavez, who was 19 years old in 1996, was the first to beg her mother to give her blessing to cross the border illegally once again. And I asked Rosa, don't you think you're going to be putting your mother through a terrible anxiety? And Rosa replied that, yes, she knew that would happen. But in her mind, she had to undertake the journey. It had become something much larger than herself, or even than her family, indeed. It was completing her dead brother's journey for them. It was giving her daughter a future. It was giving her town a future. It became this epic journey for her. And she took to the road herself and faced all the risks that her brothers had, and made it across the line, not without a grueling journey of her own, I must say.
Yeah.
It took her quite a bit of time and effort to get across the line.
When with a very young daughter in her arms.
2-year-old at the time. Through hiking, this is in the middle of winter, this is the winter of 96, 97, and they're hiking in the hills in sub-freezing temperatures, and they get deported 6 times and face every risk you can possibly imagine being exposed to the elements of the desert in the winter. But migrants tend to see these risks as acceptable, as part of the bargain. And I think also part of what Rosa's reasoning was that lightning couldn't strike twice, that just because her brothers had lost their lives didn't mean that she was going to. By and large, most migrants who try to cross that border do make it. Nonetheless, some 3,000 have died trying to make it. It's a huge number. And I think from the point of view of Mexican migrants, it's best not to dwell too much on how significant that number really is.
And once, if you make it, the gamble's well worth it.
Indeed. And this is something that's for Americans, for those of us, regarding the migrants from the north, the point of view north of the border, it's sometimes hard to understand. I've heard a lot of colleagues remark, "My goodness, look at the jobs they're taking. Look at the neighborhoods they live in." Oftentimes they get cash under the table. They have no protection whatsoever as workers. They're undocumented mostly, of course. They live in the roughest neighborhoods of our inner cities or way out in provincial areas, say the tobacco fields of the Carolinas. And the conditions look really bad to us as Americans. But from the Mexican point of view, even the slightest improvement, and oftentimes it is only a tiny bit of an improvement upon what their lives were like in Mexico, the slightest bit of mobility gives them hope. Once you stop moving, that's when hope dies. But as long as you got a slightly nicer place to live, it's a little bit more money in your pocket, you can send money back home to mom, no matter how tough your conditions are, you feel like you've won at least that initial battle. And the future is yours. And indeed, this is the Mexican migrant narrative, but it's really an American migrant narrative.
Mm-hmm. Now, my father's parents came from Ireland, and on my grandmother's side, the girls that came over, they had been orphaned in Ireland, and they worked as domestics for years. In fact, well into her 70s, my grandmother cleaned homes. So this story resonates with me, but yet, my grandmother never wanted to go back. And that is where my family's story seems to depart, because the children of Maria Elena want very much to have a foot in both worlds, to have a home in both places.
Yes, and that is what makes the Mexican migrant narrative unique, I think, in terms of our immigrant history and lore. Although it has to be said that there were other groups of migrants who came to the States Italians of the early part of the 20th century, a significant number of whom did return back to the old world.
And so did the Irish.
Significant numbers. You know, right. Not the majority, but significant numbers did. And for the Mexicans, I think it's more so, for a very simple reason. We share a border with Mexico. It's not an ocean. It's a river called the Rio Grande, or just a line in the sand, you know, between Sonora and Arizona, or California and Baja California. And as such, the old world is literally just a hop, skip, and a jump away. And that proximity makes all the difference. And I think it is also made of the borderlands a region unto itself, because the waves of migration are constant. The waves of immigrants from Ireland, from Italy, from Poland come and wax and wane, according to the times, of course. But the Mexican migrant narrative is pretty much a constant, precisely because we share this border, and because there are industries throughout the American labor economy that are always thirsty for the type of labor that Mexican migrants provide, particularly in agriculture, but also increasingly in what they call the service sector, in hotels and restaurants. It's the kid in the back washing dishes or flipping the burgers or bussing the tables or cleaning the rooms in our hotel.
Hmm. The contribution the children were making to their mother in Mexico was significant, although they were really making it was a family effort for family. It wasn't just for mom. But it was truly significant. You talk about how the sons Rosa and her husband, working several months in the United States, could come home. They worked 6 days a week, seven hours a day, or was it? No. $7 a day.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
$7 an hour, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
9 hours a day. And they saved a lot of money. And they brought it back to Mexico, which in turn helped their situation there in Mexico.
Oh, yeah. And once again, compared from our point of view, from an American middle class point of view, the amount that you can save after a season working in the strawberry fields, a couple of thousand, maybe a few thousand dollars, two or three, something like that, is not a huge amount to us. It's barely a down payment on a car, you know. But there's one very simple mathematical formula that every Mexican migrant knows, and that's the fact that you're making $5.25 or $7.25 or $9 or $10 an hour up here, and you can only make $2 or $3 a day in Mexico. And also that when a Mexican migrant returns home with dollars that are then exchanged into pesos, every migrant knows the exchange rate. And at this juncture, it's more or less 10 to 1. So the Mexican migrant returning home with thousands of dollars, a few thousand dollars, can basically play, you know, American largesse in the old country. And you see these incredible things occur as a result of this microeconomy. Migrants returning to this hometown of the Chavez brothers, for example, and literally building mansions next door to crumbling adobe homes that the poor Indians who have yet to migrate live in. You'll see these two-story, block-long buildings with tinted windows and shiny cars, shiny American, you know, trucks parked outside. And this is part of only one part of the tremendous exchange of money and culture and vision between the United States and Mexico as a result of this back-and-forth migration.
Hmm. Would you describe for us the town of Chirán and the people who live there?
Sure. It's in the state of Michoacán, which is not one of the, I think for American tourists, not one of the more well-known, although there is a region around a lake that is quite the tourist destination. It's called Pátzcuaro. But the Chirán is not in that area. It's in the highlands. And very few people who don't have business in the area or live there go there. It's not a tourist destination at all. It's basically an Indian town. The name of the Indian nation is the Purépecha Nation, which grew independently, completely independently of the Aztec culture of the Central Valley of Mexico. And so you arrive in this town, which is a big town by Highland standards, 30,000 people, but it's still completely provincial in a lot of ways. There's only a couple of paved roads, one of them being Main Street. The rest are dirt roads, and, you know, you've got livestock running around in town, you know, fouling up the traffic. But you also have, besides these classic provincial signs, satellite dishes crowning these venerable adobe homes, receiving CNN en Español in Spanish, or MTV Latino, and allowing people to watch The X-Files on Sunday at 9 o'clock along with everybody else on the continent. You'll see fleets of late model cars like the ones I mentioned earlier, all bearing license plates from, you know, about half the states in the American Union, including Delaware, Illinois, Mississippi, Kentucky, Alabama. And so it's a town that seems to can appear both to be completely indigenous, that is almost pre-Columbian, practically speaking, and completely thoroughly American urban pop at the same time. It's a very turbulent and beautiful place. I think it's both at the same time. I think it's turbulent and beautiful.
Yeah, there are the old ways and the new ways. Maybe you would tell us about Dr. Tito and the bruja, Doña Elisa.
Well, if any of your listeners, you know, are 30-something or 40-something, perhaps, you'll recall the Carlos Castaneda books, right, that were so popular in the 60s and 70s, about Don Juan, the warlock or brujo that Castaneda hung out with and allowed him to do all kinds of mystical things. A lot of those traditions are obviously very much alive in Mexico, and they are alive in Indian areas, in particular, like this small town in the highlands. And so Western medicine, the Western medical doctors like Dr. Tito, who is basically the town doctor, kind of clash and vie for the hearts and minds of the Indians with those mystical pre-Columbian traditions. I myself met up with one of the indigenous doctors or mystical healers and had a pretty amazing session with her. Chiran is a place where dreams are real. People feel that what they dream at night happens in reality, and as such, the distinction between the two is kind of blurred. Unfortunately, there's a lot of charlatans that go around also, and in the name of mystical traditions, the mystical Indian traditions, rip people off with stuff that's not magic, but just sleight of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And this family that I followed fell prey to a couple of those charlatans on a couple of occasions. But beyond that, I think by and large, most of the Indian healers do quite well in the area because people do believe, and a lot of what they're doing, by the way, is kind of just herbal medicine, which these days, of course, just about you know, any American would buy echinacea right along with the penicillin, and those traditions come from the Indians, of course. So once again, it's Chiran is this place where the venerable traditions exist right alongside the MTV type present that the migrants live.
Yeah. So Dr. Tito and the Brujas have a peace.
They somewhat.
Somewhat.
They,
yeah.
There was a time when Dr. Tito in Chiran would tell his clients to not go to those healers, the Indian healers, and tell them that it was bad medicine and just charlatanry. And the mystical healers would tell their clients the same thing, that Western medicine was no good for the Indian soul. But the enmity got so bad that eventually Doña Elisa, the indigenous healer, and Dr. Tito, the Western doctor, had to have a sit-down meeting and eventually decided that their traditions could sometimes be complementary. And so it's perfect for Chiran, you know, being this town that's both pre-Columbian and postmodern at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That the doctor, the Western doctor, and the Indian healer had this meeting of the minds and kind of like negotiated a fragile treaty between the two, so that both could continue to ply their trade in Chiran at the same time.
Yeah, a moment ago you mentioned that dreams and ghosts are real. in this part of the world, and also that these folks are watching the X-Files. And I guess I wonder, how does the X-Files resonate?
Well, I think you said it right there. They love the X-Files precisely because the point of view of indigenous Mexico that's still, that part of indigenous Mexico anyway, that still reveres the mystical traditions, totally identifies with Scully on the X-Files. You know, Mulder is the doubter, right, the cynic. No, I'm sorry, it's the other way around, isn't it? Mulder is the one that believes, and Scully is the one that doesn't believe. So Chidan and the Indians of the area love the X-Files. I can't tell you on how many occasions while I was researching, if I'd be there on a Sunday night, I'd be walking down the street and see the flickering light of somebody's TV set through the living room window and see Scully and Mulder debating the existence of ghosts and extraterrestrials and just watch and see, you know, the entire family gathered round, enraptured at the sight of the X-Files at the same time, by the way, as people in the United States are watching. Mm-hmm. So the resonance is a deep one. I mean, the people of Chidan know there's something beyond just the concrete material, everyday reality. They sense there's something much bigger, and the X-Files, of course, speaks to that directly.
Yeah. Likewise, there's been a coming together. Maybe that's not the right way to put it. I'll leave it to you. But there's an interesting, fascinating relationship between the Catholic Church and Indian religious tradition.
And that's a long-standing phenomenon that goes back practically to the conquest. In a place like Chidan, which is an Indian town, there's been, just as there's been an accommodation between Dr. Tito, the Western doctor, and Doña Lisa, the mystical healer, there's been an accommodation in terms of the church and the way the Indians revere their pantheon of gods. Basically, one can go to the church, the Church of St. Francis there in Chidan, walk inside, and, you know, right alongside the typical Catholic iconography, one will see Indian women approaching the altar, bearing baskets of fruit and other delicacies from the region, and make these offerings to the gods in the guise, to their gods in the guise of the Christian icons. It's basically, I think one term you could use for it that defines it perfectly is it's like a mestizo religion. Mestizo is the term that was given to the birth of the New World culture that resulted from the meeting of Indian and European as a result of the conquest. And so, in the Catholic Church, you had this struggle over identity. The European Church wanted to impose its identity upon the Indians, but the Indians wouldn't have it just like that. They fought to impose their identity on the church. And indeed, these days, you go to any small town in Mexico, or in the United States for that matter, and you'll see evidence of the profound indigenous influence upon the Catholic Church. And you need look no further than the Virgin of Guadalupe for evidence of that. The Virgin of Guadalupe was the first goddess to appear in the Americas and ultimately be sanctioned by the Catholic Church. And this brown-skinned Madonna is bar none the goddess of indigenous America, and precisely because she looks like an Indian and appeared to an Indian. So it's a classic case of the church being nudged by the Indians and being made according to their image rather than the other way around.
Mm. Likewise, how are the Indians nudging or pushing the larger culture of Mexico?
It's interesting. It's an interesting question because they're pushing it in many different ways. Ironically, I would have to say that one of the ways that the indigenous Mexico is pushing overall Mexican pop culture is by Americanizing it. And let me see if I can explain this phenomenon. The migrants who we see in the United States from Mexico are by and large from provincial and mostly indigenous regions of Mexico, and that has been so for many generations now. It's generally not people from Mexico City who are showing up in Chicago or St. Louis or small towns in the heartland. It's people from the states of Michoacán or Guerrero or Zacatecas, and most often it's people who are mostly indigenous. Because of that fact, it's the indigenous people of Mexico that have been the protagonists of this mixed culture that they've created after having resided in the States and then returning back home with the Chevy Silverado truck and the hip-hop music and the baggy pants the action and the Steven Seagal flicks. And this has become Mexico, an important part of Mexico's provincial culture. It's ironic in so many different ways because it's the Indians that are doing it, number one, and this highly urbanized culture is now being transplanted into a very provincial land, by and large. But it is indigenous Mexico that's been at the vanguard of this cultural transformation.
Hmm. What do you think is the upside of this transformation, and what's the downside?
And indeed, there are both.
Yeah.
In the book, I mean, I try to represent the indigenous migrant point of view as much as possible and not judge it so much myself, although I guess anyone reading the text carefully will note my own subjectivity in it. And from the indigenous point of view, it's a split decision. In the book, I describe a young Indian DJ from the town of Chinan, who is having the time of his life spinning rock and roll in Spanish, and sometimes in English, on the indigenous radio station in the town of Chinan. He is viewed with tremendous suspicion by the elders and by the state authorities, precisely because of the older generations lamenting the fact that the old ways are giving way to increasingly American popular forms. But you talk to the young DJ, and you say, but the elders are saying you're selling out, you know, to American pop, and you're losing your indigenous essence. The young DJ responds to that by saying, no, I'm as Indian now as I was before I started listening to rock music. I'm just participating of world culture as an Indian. And so it's kind of like saying, you know, that you can be regional and global at the same time. The elders, on the other hand, can wind up making quite a strong argument, saying that there's a lot of negatives to this exchange, by pointing out that through migration, families are being split apart, and because family is at the core of the Mexican Catholic and indigenous culture, that's one really regrettable effect of migration. That some of the indigenous language, the Purépecha language, is being lost. So in the span of a couple of generations, people can go from speaking the Purépecha language to just Spanish and maybe now just to English. And the elders would say, we're losing our essence. So there is a lively debate about the pros and cons here. And also the kids who are coming back from the States listening to Tupac Shakur and wearing baggies, have on occasion been the protagonists of some, at this point, mild violence in the Highlands. But still, the elders will point at the fights that break out amongst kids as signs of American decadence infecting the old world.
Yeah. I'm thinking now of a scene in the book where you're at St. Francis talking with Father Malacio, and you're talking with him about the deaths of the Chavez sons, and in this context, he tells you it's like a chain. It's a chain looped over many gears. We can't say that it begins in Chiran or in the United States. It's everywhere at once.
It's a wonderful quote, and Father Malacio is a very perceptive witness of the transformation of Chiran and indeed the world. Because that's ultimately what Chinan is. It's a place that's caught up in the throes of globalization, and shows us the extent to which globalization has seized really both provinces and urbs, both centers and margins. It'd be hard pressed to find anywhere in Mexico these days that doesn't have satellite dishes, that doesn't receive MTV in one form or another. And so Father Melesio perceptively says, look, he, by the way, is one of those who would lament the loss of the language and kids listening to rock and roll and so forth. He wants to preserve the old ways, but he realizes that Chinan is at the whim of forces much larger than Chinan, and as such is going as the town priest. You know, he can't do a whole lot other than from his pulpit try to, you know, keep his flock together through the storm of globalization. But that quote is wonderful because I think it describes the process of globalization to a T. You can't, like, put your finger on it. You can't just say to the kids, oh, stop speaking English, and then pretend that globalization has ended, because the influences in cultural and material terms are so profound and far-flung that you literally can't ever apprehend the whole.
Yeah. And then, likewise, there's a woman in the story, Loretta Panhorst, in the St. Louis area, who has been a friend of the migrant women, and she sees a benefit of, well, she sees two situations, but I think she sees a liberalization in the terms in the situation of machismo and homophobia that I think she sees that is, there's a possibility for that falling away and the situation of the women to improve. And Maria Elena is a prime example of the difficulty women face in this culture.
Absolutely. You know, machismo, which is another word for patriarchy, is such a tremendously powerful part of Mexican culture. And almost all for the worse. And it is absolutely true that somebody like Rosa Chavez, for example, surviving sibling of the brothers who died, in St. Louis, lives a life completely different than the life that she leads back home. Back home, she pretty much wears a shawl, the traditional Mexican Indian shawl called the rebozo, all the time. She might be wearing jeans at the same time, too, but she still wears the shawl. She doesn't even own one of those shawls in St. Louis. And it goes much beyond just the superficial style stuff, too. In St. Louis, her husband washes dishes occasionally, not as often as Rosa would like, probably, but occasionally. Takes care of the two daughters, because Rosa has had another daughter since the book was published. Rosa drives a car in St. Louis. She drives a tractor in St. Louis. None of these things would have occurred in the old world. And it's basically the migrants, the migrant culture on this side of the border, being contaminated by the overall American culture. No matter how hard the machos would try to keep, you know, this decidedly more liberal lifestyle out of their enclave, it's impossible. And I think the women have done a wonderful job of looking about them. Noticing the Loretta Panhorst of the Midwest, for example, and the way they comport themselves around men and what they take and what they won't take from men, and emulating that in the migrant enclave and doing so forcefully that the Mexican men, the migrant men, have no choice but to accept the new rules of living in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody, by any objective standard, this is a wonderful thing for Mexican women and men. And one of the many transformations that's occurred in this migrant world.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Ruben Martinez, we're talking with him about his book, Crossing Over, A Mexican Family on the Migrant Trail. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting for us on the toll-free line, on line 4. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Somewhere in Champaign County.
Okay.
A couple of things, and then I'll just hang up and listen. Regarding the gender divide, it seems to me interesting. I've never really heard any comment on any length about the fact that the Maquillas, whether they're now on the border or further away, since this Pueblo plan is trying to be instituted, despite the economic turndown, that those are mainly women's jobs. I think there's some change in that. But then, so, and the immigrants coming north, though not exclusively, I think is probably predominantly male. So we have this sort of divide that's happening with women taking factory jobs down there and men coming north. Though, again, maybe you can elaborate on how those figures actually do break down. Something more concrete, I don't think many Americans know about the structure of the minimum wage in Mexico, and I don't really know enough either, and I hope you do. But apparently there's three different levels, one for rural areas, one for maquillas, and one for urban areas, and that the top money factory job probably is auto worker. And it's three times the minimum wage for the metropolitan area, and I think it comes out to about $1.80 an hour. And this is the kind of wage that people get in Mexico for building PT Cruisers, which is the only place in the world they're being built, as far as I know. So I wanted you to comment on those kind of things, and I'll have to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Obviously, a listener who's very much very observant about all these issues. You mentioned the maquiladoras, which are assembly plants on the U.S.-Mexico border, and that have grown tremendously over the last couple of decades. They were precursors, actually, many of them, to the free trade agreement that had already been established in the 1960s. And the caller does point out something, that it is true that it is a mostly female workforce at the maquiladoras. So, you know, when you buy your little bookshelf stereo system, the Sanyo or Sony or whatever it is, you can probably rest assured that it was put together on the border and then brought up to the States for distribution and sale, which, by the way, makes for this very ironic little situation in which migrants, we were talking earlier about how the migrants save up money here and then go back home with it, if they're part of that migrant tradition, they'll buy, you know, a couple of nice things to take home, and what they're often buying is you know, a little stereo system that was put together in Mexico, and so they're buying it in the States to take it back to Mexico. So it's kind of like this global hall of mirrors that we live in. And it has been true, as the caller said, generally that it's more migrant men who have taken up residence and jobs in the United States. But that's been shifting over the last a couple of decades. Women increasingly come, sometimes on their own, sometimes with their husbands. Part of this is really, the women taking on part of Mexican machismo, patriarchy, and trying to have a say in family affairs and trying to keep their families together. Finally, the minimum wage in Mexico, as the caller said, it is multi-tiered, and there are auto workers that do make a wage that starts almost sounding like a first world wage. It's getting close, but those auto jobs are a drop in a vast sea of the Mexican labor economy. The rural minimum wage is the lowest. It's something like 30 pesos a day, and that's what most Mexicans make. It's a little bit better in urban areas, but by and large, as I said, most of the migrants are coming from the provincial areas, and that's where the minimum wage is the lowest.
I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. Ruben Martinez is our guest. Ruben, you mentioned in the book that your family has roots in Mexico and El Salvador, and you make your home in Los Angeles. And you also mentioned in the book that if you go to a Middle Eastern restaurant,
yeah,
you're likely to be addressed in Farsi, Persian, the language of Iran.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, given what's happening in the world today, you know, have heightened security concerns in this country, are they having an effect on migrants from Mexico and Central America?
Yes, a very direct impact, actually. Yeah, the migrants, the family that I was following, the Chavez family, they are no longer flying. They were flying. Most oftentimes they would fly Southwest Airlines. When they'd come up from Mexico, they'd cross the border, get to L.A. or Phoenix, and then take a Southwest Airlines flight to the Midwest. migrants like Southwest because they've got the cheapest fares. I'm not making a plug here for Southwest, by the way. But now the Chavez family is terrified of getting on an airline flight, Southwest or not, because of how IDs are being checked. I think that they might be exaggerating their fear a little bit because I've been flying all over the country, and I'm not even very impressed actually with the security checkpoints. But they feel that to get on a plane right now and get their fake IDs checked is almost would be like automatic deportation, and that's the buzz in the migrant communities. So instead of flying, which a lot of migrants were doing because they found it more cost effective to do so, they're not getting on planes at all. They're back on the Greyhounds. Across the country. Even in places like Los Angeles with huge Hispanic populations, there were a lot of reports, particularly in the first few days after 9/11, of Hispanics being mistaken for mm-hmm. Middle Easterners, for suspicious Middle Eastern types. Yours truly was among those who were mistaken for being Middle Eastern the days following 9/11. Suffice to say that the migrant community that lives in America is indeed fully a part of the American experience and experiencing the fallout from 9/11 in a very direct way.
Mm. We're winding down here so quickly on time, and I've got so many questions to ask. I'm gonna pick kind of another kind of contemporary political question, I guess,
sure.
to wrap up with. Would you share your observations regarding the relationship between Presidents Bush and Fox?
Yeah, it's I've often thought about them getting together like a scene out of the movie Giant. I'm not sure who Rock Hudson would be and who James Dean would be, but you know they're both ranch guys. They're both provincials. They're both very rich and come very successful families. They both have a sensibility for the border. As provincials, they have a sensitivity to the U.S. Mexico border, and that's what made for the political buzz right before 9/11, of the very real possibility before the attacks of immigration reform and an overhaul of U.S. border policy, which of course was wiped off the political table by 9/11. But it was ironic that these two men, both of them right of center politically, would finally edge so close to a really progressive notion of what the U.S.-Mexico border is. It was President Fox of Mexico who said that he envisioned the line basically disappearing in a generation. And President Bush, not quite that visionary, but was talking about regularizing the migrant flow and acknowledging it so that there doesn't have to be legals, quote-unquote, and illegals, quote-unquote. So there's just migrants with all the protections of that workers deserve and legal recognition. So it's unfortunate that after 9/11, one of the casualties was those discussions. But they'll be back on the table eventually, because 9/11 did not do away with the U.S.-Mexico border. It just made us look at it in a little bit of a different way. Now national security is part of the dialogue, and as indeed it should be. And President Fox just made some comments recently about how national security is a binational issue. And if we, as Americans, want to feel secure about our southern border, well, we better have a good relationship with our southern neighbor. Mm. And it is my hope that we will have one.
Yeah. Final question. How is the health and well-being of the Chavezes today? And have they at all been reluctant to tell you their story for publication?
No. And that was almost from the very beginning. They were very open, and probably on our second meeting 5-6 years ago now, I asked them, well, you know, I would really like to, you know, write a long story about you guys. I didn't know then it was going to be a book-length thing, but they said, sure. And I said, can I use your names? They said, sure. They were never worried about any negative repercussions. I think they figured that if the Border Patrol coming after them, that the Border Patrol would never come after them precisely because of what had already happened to them as a result of the Border Patrol chase. It would be even worse publicity for the Border Patrol. So in some ways, they don't fear the Border Patrol anymore. What more can the Border Patrol do to the Chavez family, right? And they also were very clear in telling me they wanted their story to be told as a tale of migrant suffering and migrant overcoming. They see themselves as part of something epic, of epic proportions, and they want that story told. And And I've often felt like I was less a writer than a scribe, because they were the ones that were dictating, of course, you know, what they wanted me to write about, more than, you know, my lame questions as an American outsider trying to find their story. They're the ones who helped me write it, not the other way around.
And are they well?
They are well.
Good.
Rosa has a new baby daughter, named Emily Elizabeth, and her 2-year-old, the 2-year-old that I describe in the book, is now 6 and going in her second year at parochial school in St. Louis, Missouri. So the family is doing all right.
Very good. Ruben, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Ruben Martinez has been our guest this afternoon. Look for his book, Crossing Over, A Mexican Family on the Migrant Trail. It's published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt. Also, Ruben Martinez is a contributor, a correspondent for the PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly, and you can see that program on our companion station, WILL-TV, Sunday afternoons at 1:30.